Hello and welcome back to the digital class on Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2. This is the second lesson unit on viscoelasticity. Our last lesson unit has given us an introduction to the field of rheology. In a nutshell, this field is about the question, how does a material react upon application of stress? We have seen in our last lesson unit that there is basically two extremes of reaction. The first is purely elastic response, as conceptualized within and by the mechanical element of a spring and captured by Hooke's law. The other extreme is purely viscous response, as captured by the mechanical element of a dashpot and quantified by Newton's law. This is a black and white scheme. In the present lesson unit, we will see that there is actually many gray scales in between these two extremes. And as we will see throughout the whole second part of this class, these gray scales are particularly relevant for polymer materials. Actually, many materials display both elastic as well as viscous response, depending on the conditions of an experiment or an application situation. Such materials are named viscoelastic. And strictly speaking, all matter is viscoelastic and exhibits this dualism, because depending on the timescale of observation and on temperature, a material will either more display viscous characteristics or elastic characteristics. Consider window glass as an example. When you probe this by application of stress on short timescales, like minutes or seconds, the material's response is purely elastic. So on these short timescales, you would correctly denote glass to be an ideal elastic solid. By contrast, if you would observe a glass window over the time of centuries or millennia, you would see a very slow but notable flow. On these long timescales, therefore, glass is a viscous fluid. Little footnote in this context. Some textbooks actually mention this example and refer to a proof that old ornamental windows in old cathedrals or churches are indeed thicker at their bottom than at their top, which, in that line of argument, is denoted to be due to the flow of the glass window that has occurred over the time of centuries that these old buildings have witnessed. This line of argument is qualitatively correct, but not quantitatively. Even on the timescales of several centuries, as the age of many of these old cathedrals and churches is, there indeed is flow of the window glass, but not yet to a notable extent. The reason why these glass windows actually are measurably thicker at the bottom than at the top is because in the old times when they were manufactured, this was done in an upright position, and so they exhibited flow during the period of cool down after molding into the window frame. Qualitatively, however, the very core of the foresaid argument is still correct. Indeed, the glass still flows today, but with speeds that require even longer times to lead to a notable further thickening at the bottom. Nevertheless, the core principle holds true. Generally, all materials can display viscous flow if we just give them enough time. The Greek aphorism, panta rei, everything flows, therefore not only holds true in the field of philosophy, but also in the field of rheology. For polymer systems, the viscoelastic dual behavior is very pronounced, and the range where the one transitions into the other lays on timescales that are of actual practical relevance, namely timescales of seconds to minutes, sometimes even up to hours and days. These timescales are practically relevant, and they are covered by common applications and by common normal timescale rheology experiments. And so, the behavior of both a viscous fluid and an elastic solid is actually detected. As a result, the mechanical properties of polymers are versatile and rich, and this is what makes polymers prominent for various diverse applications. We have seen in our last, that means the first lesson unit, already two different types of how rheological experiments can be conducted: uniaxial strain and shear deformation. In this lesson unit, we will see three other perspectives on how rheology experiments can be conducted, each of which possible with these two modes of deformation. So in total, it's actually six different variants of rheological experiments that we have to consider. The three that we distinguish in this present lesson unit are the relaxation experiment, the creep test, and the dynamic oscillatory experiment. The relaxation experiment derives from the Latin relaxare, which means to relieve. In a relaxation experiment, we apply a condition of an external strain to a material specimen and measure what the resulting stress in the material does as a function of time. This is shown to you in figure 65. In the case of an ideal elastic solid, we have seen already from Hooke's law that there is direct proportionality between stress and strain with the constant of proportionality of the elastic modulus. As a result of this direct proportionality, the blue graphical representation of the time-dependent strain and the green representation of the time-dependent stress in figure 65 show no visual difference. They are perfectly in phase on the time axis, meaning they have the same time course, but just different amplitudes, which is because they actually have their own ordinate axis each. The one for the stress featuring numbers in the unit Pascal, and the one for the strain featuring numbers with no unit. We could actually draw them such that they would coincide even on those axes, but most typically when we use an arbitrary scheme for numbering the axis, they don't superimpose on that axis. The differing in the absolute numbers on these two axes is actually captured by the constant of proportionality between these two quantities, the elastic modulus. In our time-dependent experiment, this very quantity is also time-dependent, and so we refer to it as the time-dependent relaxation modulus, as denoted in handwritten form underneath the dataset sketches for the elastic case in figure 65. In the other extreme case of an ideal viscous fluid, according to Newton's law, the stress in the material is not proportional to strain, but to the time derivative of strain. That means to the rate of deformation. The time-dependent course of deformation, given as the condition in figure 65, shows a steep ramp of the strain at the beginning of its application and at the end of its application. According to Newton's law, the time derivative at these two ramp positions is infinity, just with different signs. So as a result, the green sketched representation of the time-dependent stress in the material, sketched in the rightmost illustration at the bottom of figure 65, shows two infinite spikes, one reaching to plus infinity and the other reaching to minus infinity, at those positions of the time axis where the respective ramps of the strain are applied and released in the condition. The intermediate case of a viscoelastic material specimen, initially upon application of strain, shows an initial elastic response, that means an initial abrupt buildup of stress. After that, however, the viscous properties come into play and lead to a time-dependent relaxation of that stress, if the strain is then kept at a constant level, which it is in the example shown in figure 65. This is shown in the middle illustration of that figure. In some samples, this stress can actually go back to zero. In others, it cannot, but by contrast, leads to a permanent residual stress plateau. This is indicated by the dashed part of the green line in the middle representation of figure 65, and the plateau modulus connected to this is named equilibrium modulus and denotes the temporal limit of the relaxation modulus. The second general type of rheological experiment is the creep test. Here, we do the inverse as we have done in the relaxation experiment. As a condition, we now apply external stress to the material and measure the resulting time-dependent strain of the specimen. Again, the time-dependent condition that we apply is a box profile, as shown in the upper illustration of figure 66. Analogous to the relaxation experiment, in the case of an ideal elastic solid, there is direct proportionality between stress and strain, according to Hooke's law. And so the blue sketch time-dependent answer profile directly resembles, or in other words, is proportional to, and thereby doesn't exhibit any time shift, to the green sketched condition profile. In this arrangement of variables, where strain is recorded as a function of stress, Hooke's law has an inverse notation as compared to the one we have used before. And as such, also the constant of proportionality is inverse. This constant, which is the inverse of the elastic modulus, is referred to as the creep compliance, denoted by the symbol J. The other extreme of an ideal viscous fluid is mathematically characterized by Newton's law, in which stress is proportional to the rate of strain. In the condition of a creep test, as shown in figure 66, we apply a time constant stress. As this must be the derivative of strain, the time-dependent strain then has to be an integral of the applied condition of a time-dependent stress, thereby showing a linearly increasing profile if the condition is a ramp or a box profile with time-independent constant holding of the stress during the ramp, as it's considered in the case shown in figure 66. What this profile, which is shown on the right-hand-most side in the lower line of figure 66, tells us is strain increases linearly as long as stress is kept at a constant level. This is what we refer to as creep of the material. When the applied stress is relieved, the material specimen does not snap back to its original shape, as it would do if it were an ideal elastic solid, but by contrast resides in its deformed form that it has achieved during the creep period. As such, we can conclude that viscous flow is irreversible. For the intermediate case of a viscoelastic material specimen, we observe a mix of both kinds of behaviors. At the onset of application of stress, there is a certain instantaneous rise-up of strain, which is the response of the elastic part of the material. With further preceding time, the strain then proceeds further slowly, which is the hallmark of the viscous creep of the material that then sets in. We can basically sub-distinguish two further sub-cases. If the material has more elastic than viscous properties, this creeping will lead to a final plateau of the strain. We refer to such a material as a viscoelastic solid. If, by contrast, the viscoelastic material has more liquid-like than solid-like characteristics, there will be ongoing creep. We refer to this as a viscoelastic liquid. Whereas the two preceding types of experiments have applied a time constant condition to the material, a third variant of experiment does so in a time-dependent dynamic fashion. In such a so-called dynamic experiment, we apply a sinusoidally modulated oscillatory condition. That means a time-dependent sinusoidally modulated stress or a time-dependent sinusoidally modulated strain, and record the time-dependent respective other quantity in either case. Figure 67 shows the case where sinusoidal time-dependent stress is applied to the material and the corresponding time-dependent sinusoidally modulated response in strain is recorded. In a classical lecture hall setting of this class at this point, I usually give an exercise to the students in the audience. In this case, on the blackboard, I only draw the green curve of figure 67, the sinusoidally modulated condition of stress, and then ask the audience, what do you think how would the answer function, the time-dependent strain, look like? And after some thinking, together we can develop the answer. We know that in the case of a purely ideal elastic solid, according to Hooke's law, stress and strain are proportional to each other. That means the time-dependent strain, alternatively also shear deformation, will also be a sinusoidally modulated function. That means it will be in phase with the condition function, with the stress. By contrast, in the case of an ideal viscous fluid, we know that according to Newton's law, stress is the time derivative of strain. And that means if strain is a sine, then stress is a cosine. In the experimental situation that we considered in figure 67, these two variables are the other way around. We apply stress and measure strain. That means if we apply stress in a sinusoidally modulated fashion, the strain has to be the antiderivative of that, in German Stammfunktion, which is a minus cosine wave. In either constellation, however, stress and strain are 90 degrees out of phase to each other. That means there is a phase angle of 90 degrees, or pi half if you like that better, between these two. As viscoelastic materials are something between these two extremes, we can conclude that they must exhibit a phase angle between 0 and 90 degrees, or between 0 and pi half if you like that better. In other words, for these materials, the response function will also be a sine wave, exhibiting a phase shift between the two extremes of 0 degrees and 90 degrees, or pi half. That means we can write the answer function like it's done in the blue handwritten form in figure 67. It is a wave curve exhibiting a phase angle that shifts it from the green denoted stress wave curve. The phase angle is 0 for an ideal elastic solid, it's 90 degrees or pi half for an ideal viscous fluid, and it's something in between for a viscoelastic material. A little footnote here also to the amplitudes of these functions. Those are drawn differently in figure 67, which is to emphasize that here we have two functions sharing one ordinate that actually have their own ordinates each, also with different units. The ordinate for the stress features numbers with the unit of pascals, whereas the ordinate of strain features numbers with no physical dimension. And in the common plot, the amplitudes turn out to differ, to an extent expressed by the concept of proportionality between them, the elastic modulus. The mathematical notion of the two functions at the top of figure 67 is done in a complex number notation. We could also write this with trigonometric functions here, but this would be mathematically more nasty to work with, so we prefer the simpler notation with the exponential function of an imaginary argument. With that, we will see in a minute that the constants of proportionality between stress and strain, which are the elastic modulus or its inverse, the creep compliance, and the viscosity, will turn out to be in fact complex quantities in such a dynamic experiment. We remember from our first lesson unit, in Hooke's law, the elastic modulus is simply the constant of proportionality between stress and strain. That means it's obtained by dividing the one by the other. It is the ratio of stress over strain. In a dynamic experiment, if we take these two notations from figure 67, the two complex notations for stress and strain, and calculate this ratio, it turns out that the elastic modulus is a complex quantity, as denoted in equation 5.7a. For the very related variant of shear deformation, the result is also a complex quantity, named the complex shear modulus in that case, as denoted in equation 5.7b. With Euler's formula, these equations which feature an exponential form of an imaginary argument can be split into a real and an imaginary part, as denoted in equations 5.8a and 5.8b. The two parts of these moduli, the real and the imaginary parts, are named storage modulus and loss modulus. The real part, the storage modulus, captures the elastic properties of a material, whereas the imaginary part, the last part, captures the viscous properties. We can read out these two parts directly from the equation pair 5-8, which gives us the equation pairs 5-9 and 5-10. We can see from these that the extent of the real and the imaginary parts to the modulus, that means the extent of the storage and the loss capabilities of the material, depend on the phase angle. If the phase angle is zero, that means if we deal with an ideal elastic solid, the imaginary parts E double prime and G double prime are zero. Because according to the equation pair 5-10, in that case we have the sine factors in these equations to be the sine of zero, and that is zero. This means, in this case, only the elastic parts E prime and G prime fully make up the complex moduli, E star or G star. Because in that case, according to the equation pair 5.9, for these real parts, we then have the cosine factor in this equation as cosine of 0, and that is 1. By contrast, in an ideal viscous fluid with a phase angle of 90 degrees or pi half, it's just the other way around. Then the real parts, E prime and G prime, are 0, because then in the equation pair 5.9, the cosine factor features a cosine of 90 degrees or a cosine of pi half, which is 0. So the viscous parts, E double prime and G double prime, fully make up the complex moduli E star and G star. Because in that case, according to the equation pair 5-10, we then have a factor of sine 90 degrees or sine pi half for these parts, and that is 1. In an intermediate case of a viscoelastic material, both parts contribute to the complex moduli. And here, depending on the phase angle, either the one or the other is greater in its magnitude of contribution, and therefore potentially dominates the complex modulus. The extent of domination of these storage or loss modulus contributions to the complex moduli E star or G star can be judged from their ratio, that means E double prime over E prime, or G double prime over G prime. According to a simple trigonometric consideration, which is shown in figure 68, these ratios can be simply described as the tangent of the loss angle delta. This quantity is therefore referred to as the loss tangent. If tangent delta is greater than 1, that means in the ratio of E double prime or G double prime over E prime or G prime, the numerator dominates over the denominator. In other words, the value of the loss modulus, which is the one in the numerator, is greater than the value of the storage modulus, which is the one in the denominator. For the material properties, this means that the imaginary part, the loss part, is more important than the real part, the storage part. So the viscous parts of the material mechanical properties are more dominant than the elastic parts. And we have a viscoelastic liquid. By contrast, if tangent delta is smaller than 1, then it's just the other way around. The value of the storage modulus in the denominator of the ratio of E or G double prime over E or G prime is greater than the value of the loss modulus in the numerator of these ratios. That means, in this case, the elastic parts of the sample mechanical characteristics dominate, and we have a viscoelastic solid. In the case right in the middle, where tangent delta is exactly 1, the elastic and viscous parts contribute equally. So far, we have a quite mathematical understanding of the moduli. Can we also give this some practical illustration? Yes, we can. Consider a simple specimen, like a rubbery bounce ball, that is dropped by a person from a certain height, like the height of the arm of this person, as shown in figure 69. This rubbery bounce ball will hit the ground and bounce back and shoot back up, but it won't reach back the initial height that it had before. The reason is not friction by air here, but dissipation of some of the energy during the bounce. The part of the height that is gained back after the bounce is reflected by the energy storage that has occurred and has then been released into a reverse motion during the bounce. This part therefore corresponds to the elastic part of the modulus, the storage modulus. Whereas the other part, the loss in height, corresponds to the energy dissipation that has occurred during the bounce, the loss modulus. This example gives us a macroscopic illustration of what the storage and the loss parts of the moduli are. Can we also connect this to a microscopic picture of the material internal structure? This is what we actually seek for in this lecture series, in our endeavor to unravel structure property relations. Yes, we also can. This will be outlined to you in a later lesson unit. I can foretake already the bottom line. A bouncy ball made of rubber is constituted out of a polymer network structure. On nanoscopic scales, this polymer network has a mesh topology, and the tightness of these meshes determines the elastic modulus, as upon deformation, the deformation energy is stored within stretched polymer network strands, microscopically. Dissipation of energy happens by structural features that are part of the network but not capable of taking part in the energy storage. That means not capable of getting stretched and therefore storing energy. Structural features like that are loose dangling chains or elastically ineffective loops in the network. We will conceptualize this in a lot more detail in our sixth lesson unit on rubber elasticity. And there we will also see how the microscopic structural features of that rubbery material directly translate into material properties, namely the elastic modulus. And here at this point, in the example of figure 69, we see how this further translates into macroscopic observable response and function. This chain of conceptual insight, how microscopic chemical structure translates into macroscopic physical parameters and phenomenological response, is exactly what is in the scope of our lecture target. And this is also exactly what will be on the agenda in your later profession as developing materials chemists in research and development, both in an industrial and academic surrounding. Users, which in industry also means customers, will not approach you with the intent to get a certain beautiful chemical structure from you, but with the intent to get a function. What you then have to do is to reverse the foresaid line of thought. You have to translate the desired function into measurable physical parameters, such as the elastic modulus, and then further translate this into microscopic chemical structures, like the one of a polymer network, that will deliver it. The latter example specifically targets at elastic properties. Let's also have a regard on viscous characteristics. In fact, by a dynamic experiment, we can not only determine a complex elastic modulus, but also its inverse, which is a complex creep compliance. And as we will see in a minute, in view of Newton's law, we can also determine the sister quantity of the complex viscosity. We know that the creep compliance is just the reciprocal of the elastic modulus. That means the complex creep compliance, which we refer to as J star, is just the reciprocal of the complex modulus, meaning 1 over E star or 1 over G star. It is the ratio not of stress over strain, but strain over stress. For the case of an oscillatory deformation experiment, now for example in a shear scenario, this quantity calculates as denoted in equation 5.12a. By expanding this complex number, by applying a little mathematical trick, we get to the form expressed in equation 5.12b. Here we see that the complex creep compliance, just like the complex modulus, consists of two parts, a real and an imaginary one, which are just the inverse of the corresponding real and imaginary parts of the complex moduli. In an analogous fashion, we can also calculate the complex viscosity. Let's consider again a dynamic oscillatory shear deformation experiment and calculate the viscosity as noted in equation 513a. Some further transformation over the intermediate step of equation 5.13b leads us to the form of equation 5.13c. Once more, we see that this quantity is composed of a real and an imaginary part. Note the delicate difference to the creep compliance, though. Here, the real part of the viscosity has to do with the imaginary part of the modulus, and vice versa. The imaginary part of the viscosity has to do with the real part of the modulus. This is because the meaning of viscosity and modulus are just antipodes. Whereas viscosity denotes energy dissipation, modulus denotes energy storage. And so the real part of the dissipation quantity must correspond to the imaginary part of the storage quantity, and vice versa. When we regard this quantity specifically for polymer systems, that means polymer solutions or melts, we have to make ourselves clear that it is a lot different than what we know from classical low molar mass fluids. In this context, in the setting of a classical lecture hall realization of this class, again, I usually ask a question to the student audience by asking if there is one brave voluntary student in the audience who would like to come up front and draw to the blackboard a so-called flow curve, which is a graphical plot of stress on the ordinate versus strain rate or shear rate on the abscissa. How would such a curve look like? The solution is simple. According to Newton's law, that should be a straight line passing through the origin, as stress in Newton's law is simply proportional to the strain rate, with a constant of proportionality, which is the viscosity. If we indeed observe such a flow curve in an experimental situation, we refer to that as ideal Newtonian flow. Polymer solutions and melts, by contrast, often show deviations from this ideal behavior, which we then refer to as non-Newtonian flow. We can basically distinguish two scenarios, shear thinning and shear thickening, both represented in figure 70a. Shear thinning is very important and frequent in polymer systems. In this scenario, viscosity decreases as the shear rate increases. The microscopic picture behind that observation is that the application of a shear force destroys possible aggregate structures in our sample. And if it's composed of chain molecules, orients these chains along the direction of the shear gradient, thereby facilitating their mutual displacement and thereby enabling easier flow of the liquid. Such a shear thinning behavior is actually often wanted in applications when soft materials shall flow under the application of shear force but reside in place when no such force is applied. A famous practical example is if you want to put paint onto the wall. You want the paint to be easily applicable as long as you exert shear onto it by brushing it, but as soon as you stop brushing, you want it to stay in place and not exhibit dripping. So paints are actually purposely engineered such to show shear thinning flow. Other examples are butter on toast or toothpaste. These are also materials that you want to exhibit flow as long as you apply shear force, for example with your knife when you spread the butter on your toast, or as long as you squeeze the toothpaste tube. But as soon as you stop doing that, you want these materials to no longer flow but stay in place then. There is another example in which shear thinning turns out to be beneficial in the polymer application. This is one which is right from the core of the polymer engineering discipline. Polymer materials are very often processed by the technique of extrusion. In this process, polymer melts are squeezed through thin nozzles, and as we have just seen during that squeezing, they exhibit a change of their microscopic structure in a sense that chains are oriented and extended into the direction of flow. And if such a melt then rapidly cools down after the extrusion and then solidifies, for example in the context of extruding a foil, the polymer chains are locked in this non-equilibrium conformation. This can actually be utilized in applications, for example in so-called shrink foils that can be used to enwrap foodstuff, for example. If such shrink foils are heated, the polymer chains that are entrapped in it in an unnatural conformation can relax back to their natural coiled conformation, which comes along with a decrease of volume, and as such the whole foil shrinks and can thereby serve for airtight packaging of goods such as foodstuff. In 1925, Ostwald referred to shear thinning as structural viscosity, because in that case, a sample in fact changes its microscopic structure, as we have just illustrated for the example of polymer chains in shrink foils. As a little add-on, the unnatural orientation of the elongated and parallel oriented chains in the shrink foil after the extrusion process also manifests itself such that these foils cause light polarization, which can be easily checked by viewing upon them with a polarizer in between the eye and the foil at different orientations of the polarizer. As useful as the non-Newtonian flow, for example the shear thinning, may be in applications, it actually poses a challenge in scientific materials research. If we want to probe the viscosity of polymer melts or non-dilute solutions, we have to make ourselves clear that it may delicately depend on the rate of deformation that we apply in an experiment, which we, however, have to apply at some finite realization in such a situation. What is done to take this into account properly is that we probe the sample at multiple finite extents of shear rates and extrapolate the viscosity to a shear rate of zero. We refer to this as the zero shear viscosity, eta zero, in which limit the shear thinning curve in figure 70a approaches the Newtonian straight line. A variant of shear thinning is materials referred to as Bingham fluids, as shown by the uppermost graph in figure 70b. These materials exhibit a certain finite intercept, a flow threshold, corresponding to a specific yield stress. That means they act like a solid at zero or very low shear, but above a certain threshold, they start to flow like a Newtonian fluid. The microscopic reason for this is that there is a certain finite stress in the material necessary to break certain aggregate structures, mediated by interactions between the material's building blocks, such as hydrogen bonding patterns. Examples are again toothpaste or mayonnaise or ketchup. You may all know this famous experiment where you shake a bottle of ketchup too heavily and then splash the ketchup all over your plate. A variant of this is the Casson fluid, which acts like a Bingham fluid, but then furthermore exhibits shear thinning once the yield stress has been achieved. The opposite deviation from pure Newtonian flow is shear thickening. In this case, the viscosity of the sample increases as the shear rate increases. The microstructural explanation for this behavior is a little more complicated. It assumes the existence of transient hydrodynamic clusters of the particles or molecules that constitute the material. These can spontaneously form and break. At high shear rates, however, the shear oscillation period gets shorter than the lifetime of these clusters. And it means on the time frame of a shear oscillation period, they have an infinite lifetime. thereby imparting great hindrance on flow during that cycle. An example for this behavior is a wet suspension of water and sand. Perhaps you have made the following experiment during holidays at the beachside. If you stand at the beach, you can bury your feet into wet sand if you carefully and slowly dig into it. If you then, however, try to abruptly pull the feet out, it is stuck like in concrete. The reason is exactly the one that we have just addressed. At low deformation rates, which are applied when you carefully and slowly dig your feet into the wet sand, the viscosity of the suspension is low. At high deformation rate, by contrast, which are applied when you try to abruptly pull your feet out, the viscosity of the suspension is very high, prohibiting your feet to escape. Just for the sake of completeness, there is two further variant kinds of complex rheological behavior, which are referred to as thixotropy and rheopaxy, both denoting time-dependent rheological behavior. In thixotropy, the viscosity of a sample decreases over time, whereas in the context of rheopaxy, it increases over time. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. We have learned about three fundamental types of how to probe material characteristics in rheology. The most important one is the dynamic experiment, because this delivers us frequency and thereby inversely also time-dependent properties. A central outcome of our consideration of dynamic experiments in this lesson unit was that the central quantities that we discuss in the realm of rheology, the elastic modulus, the creep compliance, and viscosity, turn out to be complex quantities. This may appear frightening at a first glance, but it is actually very insightful on a second glance, because with that, these quantities actually reflect both the ability to store and to dissipate external deformation energy. And as we have indicated already several times, this is particularly relevant and pronounced for polymer materials. In the mid and the second half of the 20th century, the French physicist Pierre-Gilles de Gennes recognized striking universality of the rheological behavior and characteristics of polymer materials and other materials constituted of colloidal scale building blocks, such as amphiphilic self-assemblies, hard sphere colloidal particles, or liquid crystals, and summarized these materials under a new class named soft matter. This consideration enabled fundamental new insights into physics, because representatives of soft matter, due to the large size and thereby also slow motion of their building blocks, are easy to observe. But the basic physics behind, for example, phase transitions or ordering phenomena are the same as in classical materials. This insight was awarded with a Nobel Prize in Physics in the year 1991. And in his Nobel Prize lecture, de Gennes opened with the words, "What do we mean by soft matter? Americans prefer to name it complex fluids. This is a rather ugly name, which tends to discourage the young students." In our present lesson unit, we have learned about the complex nature of the fundamental mechanical material properties today, which is one reason why scientists, specifically from the Anglo-American regions, refer to these as complex fluids. De Gennes expressed his disfavoring of that nomenclature and rather introduced the term soft matter instead, because, as just said, a reason that he named for that was that the term complex may frighten off or discourage students. I hope that after this present lesson unit, you don't feel discouraged, but instead recognize the potential deep and general insight that can emerge from that.